I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. The book is already highly regarded with some tremendous reviews. It's called The Good Soldiers, and it's been compared to the works of Ernie Pyle, Black Hawk Down, and The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. One reviewer said it was the best war book since the Iliad. Its author, David Finkel, not only profiles the United States Army soldiers of the 2nd Battalion, 17th Infantry Regiment of the 4th Infantry Brigade Combat Team, 1st Infantry Division, also known as the 216 for short. He also gives us a view of the war and the loved ones at home. Between January 2007, as President George W. Bush announced a new strategy for Iraq, and June 2008, Finkel, a reporter for the Washington Post, spent 8 months with the soldiers. He goes with them in Baghdad, finds out about their lives, who they are, and seeing firsthand the surge and whether it's a success. It's a compelling book, timely and obviously illuminating on this war that's consumed all of us, even those outside of the United States. David Finkel is a staff writer for the Washington Post, and he received the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for his reporting on a series of stories about U.S.-funded democracy efforts in Yemen. The Good Soldiers is published in Canada by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, David Finkel. Good morning, Mr. Finkel.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
How did you come to this story? Your work at the Post, I guess you covered the war in Iraq?
Well, I did. I've covered several wars for the Post, Kosovo, Afghanistan, the beginning of Iraq. This was a bit different. It began as an assignment from the Washington Post. They wanted me to write about the next group of soldiers heading into the just-announced surge. That took me out to Fort Riley, Kansas, where a brigade of soldiers was about to head out. And while out there, I met a battalion commander of an infantry battalion, 800-some soldiers heading over there. And there was just something about the commander, about the moment, about the situation that made me want to write more than a newspaper story. So I took a leave from the Post for a couple of years, went to Baghdad, wrote the book.
The commander, that's Ralph Kos... How do you pronounce it? Kosarich,
yes.
Kosarich. Now, the 800 troops at Fort Riley, are they all from the area, or do they come from different parts of the
country? No, they were a collection. I'd like to say from all over America, but as I'm sure everyone understands now, the military is it doesn't cut across all of America like it did back in the days of the draft. Certain pockets of the country are more represented, certain economic pockets. But they came together at Fort Riley. That's where they were assigned to, into this battalion. And it wasn't just that they were about 800 soldiers. It's the fact that most of them were on their first deployment. At that point, the average age in the battalion was 19 years old. And so off these kids went into their very first war.
So while you're writing the book, or while you're on... you're in Iraq with them. Are you reporting for the paper?
You know, I did a few pieces for the paper just because where this battalion ended up in East Baghdad was both a vicious place and also at times a pretty lonesome place. And just to feel some sense of connection with people back home, and I would write a few stories for the paper now and then. But mostly it was all reporting for this the book.
And what was your goal as the author? It was obviously to tell a story. Is this one of the first books on the war in Iraq?
Well, there have been so many books at that point. If you think back to January 2007, there were a couple things going on. I know we all sort of might be thinking the war is winding down. That may or may not be true. But at that point, the war was going full bore, and it seemed to have arrived by some consensus at the moment where it seemed all but lost. And that was interesting to me as a writer. The other thing is that by that point in the war, 4 years in, the great policy books had been done. Memoirs had come out, memoirs of soldiers, but there hadn't been the kind of intimately observed journalistic book done that has been done in other wars, and that's the book I decided to try to do. There were only two promises made at the beginning. I promised Kosarich and his soldiers that I was coming over there without any agenda that I wasn't there to say the war is good or war is bad, that the surge was a success or a failure. It was merely to chronicle their experiences at that moment as soldiers. And in return, their promise to me was if I came over, they would give me full access to what was going on. And in fact, that's what happened.
Did it take a lot of convincing?
No, it didn't. There was something, well, yes and no. To the command staff, no. They were eager to have someone witnessing what they were going through, whatever it was. Now, you know, again, the thing about this is I went into it not knowing what the outcome would be. It was just an idea, and off I went. They seemed rather eager for someone to be chronicling their story. The farther you went down into the ranks of soldiers who were told suddenly that a journalist would be among them, I think there was some suspicion at the beginning, and it took a while to overcome that, to gain their trust. I don't think I did entirely with every soldier, but the longer I stayed, the more I was around for bad things, and when bad things happened, the fact that I didn't become a problem for the soldiers, but I stayed in my lane, taking notes, asking questions, I think trust developed from that.
And this idea of trust, one thinks that, you know, because you are a journalist, whether you're in any social circumstance or professional circumstance, you act differently. Did you feel that they acted differently because you were who you were?
It always happens, and, you know, it takes a while for people to begin to relax and show life as it would be occurring as if I weren't present. And I don't assume that ever happens entirely, but one thing I've learned is the more you spend time and the more you listen and show curiosity, people begin to want to talk to you more and more, and that was the case in Iraq as well.
Ralph Kozlerich, he's the head of the command, I guess. He's just such a fascinating guy in the book. Did you spend much time with him in terms of, how much time do you spend? Do you spend a day, or how does it work?
Well, there were only two things to do in a day, either hang out with the soldiers I was writing about or be by myself in my room, a dark room except for a fluorescent light, sandbagged windows, the rest of it. So after a while, after I went through notes, I'd go a little crazy and go out and join the soldiers. That was often Kozlerich, or the other soldiers I chronicle in the book.
He's such a, as I said, a fascinating guy.
They all are.
Yeah. But what about him?
Well, he was the most. I think he struck me as a very, very bright man, a very able soldier, especially tactically. He, in meetings, he was always the fastest guy, fastest thinker in the room, the one with the best memory, the one who could pull the most context into a decision. And as the months and months went by, I learned a lot from watching him be a leader of this battalion. But that was one part of it. I learned just as much as from watching the soldiers under his command contend with what they faced. I mean, these were pretty optimistic, naive, patriotic guys when they left. They really wanted to get to this war. They were excited about the mission, and they were probably on the ground 14 months in Baghdad, and by the time they left to come back to America, that had changed. The optimism was tempered. The mission had become a mission of, I'm only here for the guy next to me, and they were no longer 19 and naive. They were obviously profoundly changed.
Do you find that these 19-year-olds that go over there, that they're emotionally prepared for battle?
Who could be prepared for what happened over there? I'd love to say yes, but I don't think anyone was prepared for what happened during that 14-month period. They, like I said, they went to a tough area, and it was just luck of the draw that they ended up there. And when they after they adjusted and thought they were doing well, and then they began receiving injuries, and then soldiers began dying, and then more soldiers were injured, and more soldiers died, of course that changes your outlook about everything.
And their view of the mission, did they understand it going in?
They seemed to. They said they did. They were pretty gung-ho about the thing. They wanted to be there. But by the end, much less so.
And they tell you that, of course.
Sure, but yeah. That's one of the things that developed over time. As they began to seek me out privately to talk to me about what was going on in their own minds, about what they were seeing, what they were encountering, what they were feeling. I think I became a useful person for them to talk to privately. And when I say privately, they understood it was for a book, but it was away from a group, and it was a chance for them to talk out loud about what they were seeing and contending with. And again, it was some pretty severe stuff.
The things that they were talking about, were they sort of the same things that we were talking about here? I mean, in your country and you know, elsewhere, away from Iraq, about whether the surge was working and the sort,
no.
Like that?
No, they were just talking about how screwed up things seemed to be, and there was a lack of understanding why, if they were there trying to restore some sense of peace and stability to an area, some of the people in the area kept attacking them again and again. He was just coming to terms with that. Now, that may seem obvious to you why that happened, but there in the midst of it, it's something that they were always wondering about, sometimes quizzically and sometimes quite angrily.
And so the relationship with the Iraqis, that how does that work? I mean, they don't understand why they're being attacked by people they're trying to help. What do they think of the Iraqi people?
Well, I don't want to overgeneralize.
Yeah.
I think, but based on the conversations, based on my notes, the Iraqi people in general, they seem not to have a gigantic problem with. There was a passivity sometimes they didn't understand, but it was the insurgents hidden in the population, sometimes in plain sight. It was some of the Iraqi police and army members who seemed to be doing very little to protect the American troops who were over there. That's where their frustration was, and also it's a struggling, screwed up, corrupt place. And so when there were efforts to bring some sense of American order to that place, and those efforts were rebuffed or didn't quite come through, then there was some frustration. But look, it was more than that. I mean, if I can just explain this area for a minute of East Baghdad, it was outside of Sadr City. It was a tough, tough area, mostly Shiite at that point. I guess it still is. And the weapon of choice there was a type of roadside bomb that was just so ever-present and insidious that seeing and feeling the effects of those bombs, which were directed at them and went off every day as they passed by, that's where the anger and frustration came from. And whether you agree with it or not, I think you can see it's when you're getting slammed all the time, it's somewhat understandable.
Do you think people in your country, Americans, and people who are pro-war or staying there or against it, do you think they understand what's going on there? And I mean, as the author of this book, was that one of your goals, to sort of frame the war in the minds of people in your country, in America?
I got the sense that this war was two wars. There was the one being fought in Washington, of strategy and of politics and of money, which is, I guess, the war as it ought to be thought of in the capital of this country. But to the soldiers over there, the war was September 4th when a roadside bomb tore into a Humvee and three soldiers were dead. I mean, what else could war be? But to people here, you open up the paper one day and you might see a headline that says three more killed in a roadside bomb in Baghdad, and a reader might pause and say a prayer, or that's about the extent of it. What the book aims to do is add the details of what that sentence in the newspaper means, as experienced by these young men. So their experiences, the details, the intimate details of what they went through every day, become part of the larger conversation about this war and any war.
How did going there affect your reporting? in terms of how your report, I mean, has it changed, do you think, after all these years in journalism?
Has my reporting changed?
Yeah, has your view of your work?
No, I hope I answer this correctly. I think it's the same moves as ever. I was there because I was curious about witnessing something where no one else was. I like that type of journalism where I end up in a place or a hidden corner of some importance, and I get to stay long enough to try to figure it out and to write honestly and with some authority about it. That's what I've always liked to do in journalism, and that was the attempt here as well.
Was there any moment that you felt scared for your own safety?
Well, yeah, I was scared all the time. And
how do you deal with that, though?
Well, I had a luxury that the soldiers didn't have, and which was that after 4 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever it was, when I felt myself getting a little too scared to do good work, I could get out. I could get on a helicopter. I could fly into the green zone. I could walk out of the green zone and be picked up by the Washington Post security team, which would take me to the Washington Post house, where I could spend a few days. I could drink. I could sleep late and not worry about rocket or mortar attacks. I could kind of get refreshed and then go back to the base I was on, where I was doing my reporting. Or I could come back to the States for a few weeks, see my family, do some reporting here. That's an enormous thing. The soldiers didn't have that luxury. They, one more thing about these roadside bombs, the way they were designed, it's really a piece of copper about the size of a dinner plate at the end of a tube of explosives. And when someone would see an American convoy and push a button, that disc would be propelled forward and it would become semi-molten and burn through whatever was in front of it, whether it was the very best Humvee in the U.S. Army or all the soldiers inside. So these 19-year-old soldiers, and then as they stayed there, you know, became 20-year-old soldiers, they began adapting by doing calculations that 19- and 20-year-olds ought not to do, sitting with one foot in front of the other so when the charge came in they would lose one foot, not two, making a game of what their last words would be, sometimes vulgar, sometimes heartbreaking, tying horseshoes for good luck to the front of a Humvee, whatever they could do to get through a day and another mission. And they didn't get to choose. They didn't get out like I got out. They had to do this day after day for the length of the mission.
I remember some of these moments from the book as you're telling us about them. Do you find that the troops there that they're hopeful, or does that sort of, as you say, does that diminish as they get older?
I don't know if hopeful is quite the right word. I'd like to think about it. I know they went over believing in what they were going to try to do. At the end, some returned home, still believing that they had accomplished something or other, but quite a lot of them were disillusioned, especially because at the end, when they were packing up to go, after having served so much time in that place and thinking perhaps they had made a difference because things had gotten quieter, suddenly the place just exploded into the worst violence of their war, and for more than a week, it was just all-out, flat-out combat, 24 hours a day, in which more soldiers were injured and a couple more were killed. And the effects of that, not only in the short term, were disillusioning to a lot of the men, but they linger. It's still in their minds. What happened? What was that about? What did we do in the end? It's the war for them, for a lot of these guys, continues to be an open question.
I listen to IMIS every day. And I hear him talking about this rise in traumatic brain injuries of troops coming home with those in large numbers, and then when your colleagues at the Washington Post had those series of articles on Walter Reed,
yeah,
and he talked about that and the appalling conditions there. Are the troops that are coming home now, are they getting better care?
The physical care I saw was extraordinary. And I think the Walter Reed series helped deal with and improve well, I hope forever, but at least temporarily, the long-term care. The problem that Walter Reed exposed wasn't with the initial care, but with the long-term care as patients soldiers tried to recover. The mental care is the big question mark. A lot of these soldiers have come back with PTSD, with traumatic brain injury from being in so many explosions, and all the things you see in soldiers after any war. There's a lot of it, and they're dealing with it, but in many cases they're dealing with it on their own. And anecdotally, I can tell you that the U.S. Military isn't doing a very good job with treating these mental injuries.
There's a heartbreaking story of one soldier that you write in the book. His wife finds him in the kitchen. I guess he fell down.
Oh yeah, Michael Emery.
And they ask him later. He said that he had hoped that he'd died.
Well, Michael was a guy who early in the deployment was on a roof when the sniper sighted him and shot him in the back of the head, and down he went with a very critical injury. And it took a while. I mean, Michael is still alive. There's been a lot of rehabilitation. But he was flown to Landstuhl in Germany and then back to Washington, D.C., to the suburbs, to Bethesda Naval, and then many other places for a long, long recovery. But along the way, at some points, according to his wife, he had tried to kill himself a few times, and yet he was a man who could barely move. He was in a wheelchair, and so he would, one day he asked for a pencil, another day he just tried to tip himself over, another day he just tried to basically bite through his wrists until somebody found him. So for Michael Emery, a very good soldier, the war continues, as it does for another soldier named Adam Schumann. And Adam Schumann, by all accounts, was one of the very best soldiers in this battalion. Adam Schumann was on his third deployment to Iraq. He had been in country for about 1,000 days, and when Michael Emery was shot in the back of the head, it was Adam Schumann who put Emery on his back and took him down 3 flights of stairs so he could get to an aid station. Along the way, all the blood from Michael Emery's wound filtered down into Adam Schumann's mouth, and he carried this man and kept spitting out his blood. And 6 months later, Adam Schumann was still tasting Michael Emery's blood and simply had enough. He had to go home. And so so he guiltily left the war, left his fellow soldiers, not on a regular helicopter, but on a Red Cross helicopter, the helicopter reserved for the wounded and the dead. And that's how Adam Schumann left the war. He's back home in Kansas now, and the war goes on for him as well.
Well, what do the families think of this book? What do the troops think that you talk about in the book? What do they think of their portrayal here?
Oh, you know, I guess one of the most gratifying things about this whole thing has been the emails I've gotten, both from families of the dead soldiers and the soldiers themselves. And if there's a common theme to the soldier emails, I guess it would be along the lines of a soldier writing to me to say, you know, I got home. And everyone wanted to know, what was it like? And I didn't want to talk to them, and I didn't want to describe it, and I still don't want to talk about it. But now I can hand over your book and say, read this book, and you'll know what it was like, and you'll understand why I don't want to talk. So that's a good thing to hear from these soldiers.
And we hear this timeline in 2011. That's when American troops leave Iraq, but
right.
That's what, I guess, is that when the surge sort of winds down? But I mean, troops will always be there, right?
They're going to be there for a long time, at least on the perimeter. You know, we're, when I say we, I mean Americans are out of the major cities now, but there's still 120,000 troops in country, and it takes a while to get all those folks out, and some are coming home, and some will, you know, go on to the next thing, into Afghanistan. And so here we are at a moment where President Obama is about to decide or about to announce what he's going to do with his Afghanistan policy. And I don't know. It just seems to me, I was so glad as a citizen who had witnessed war when Obama a few weeks ago in the middle of the night went over to Dover to watch the return of 18 dead Americans in coffins. And, you know, there's plenty of argument what his motives were. Were they political motives? Were they more humane? In the end, having been through so many of those memorial ceremonies, the motives don't matter in the end, because if you do what he did, go on the plane four times and escort coffins out, and then stand there and watch all of them go by, it affects you. It's something that you don't shake. And so if the book works, and me talking about what happened to these soldiers, Adam Schumann, Michael Emery, a soldier named Duncan Crookston, who on the very day that George Bush was in Australia saying, "We're kicking ass," was in a Humvee that was hit by a roadside bomb. He lost both his legs, his arm, most of his other arm. He spent 4 months in the hospital, 30 surgeries. His eyes were sutured shut. His ears fell off. His burned nose fell off. His eyebrows were gone. His eyelids finally were gone. Bolted to a bed, unable to move. That's the effects of war. And so if that can be part of the conversation about what these decisions mean, then that's a good thing to me.
How were you doing? I mean, you were there. You talk about this witnessing these ramp ceremonies and the sort. I mean, emotionally, I mean, may I ask how you're doing?
I think I'm doing okay. But again, I didn't have the pressure the soldiers did, because I could get away. And I can't minimize how much that helped. I'm not saying soldiers need to get away. I'm just pointing out that whatever I'm feeling is not a stand-in for what soldiers are feeling, because they didn't get to get away. They had to get in the Humvee every day and go out into these neighborhoods where these roadside bombs were waiting. And it was a 24-hour a day, 7 day a week war for them. They were always on the front line. There was no pattern to the enemy. There was no pattern to what was going to happen. So every moment over there was unbelievably tense. So the question of how I'm doing is an easy question. I'm doing okay. I got to write a book. But the question of how the soldiers are doing is something I wish Americans were more preoccupied with.
David, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I was going to say it's a pleasure to read the book, but it's a difficult book at times. But it's one that is just a great book and a necessary one. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Well, thanks on that, and I'm just so glad to have the chance to talk about it, so thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Good Soldiers. It's published here in Canada by Douglas and McIntyre. Do pick it up. The Washington Post's David Finkel on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.